and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast. Today's conversation is all about focusing on employee well-being and how leaders and organisations that focus on the well-being of their people can build better leaders and better, more productive organisations. Today we are joined by Claire Burns. Claire is the founder of a consultancy company called Workplace Wellbeing. Workplace Wellbeing help organisations create happier, healthier workplaces. Today's conversation is probably more aimed at HR teams and also leaders that work with teams that maybe have wellbeing, mental health, physical health, or stress-related problems. It's a great conversation, a really worthwhile listen around some of the nuances around workplace well-being, around some of the nuances around how well-being and productivity are linked. And there's some great coaching content here around how you can have better, less judgmental, more empathetic conversations with people in your organisation to ultimately ensure that you're creating a happier, healthier workplace. Claire shares some of her personal experiences, including having an ectopic pregnancy and going into the menopause, age 37, and some of the challenges that she then faced, which really spurred her on and encouraged her to step away from a role in corporate HR and to help organisations take a better approach to workplace well-being. It's a great conversation. Let's get into it. Claire, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Would you like to introduce yourself, what you're all about, and what is workplace well-being?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you know, then my name is Claire Burns. I'm founder of Workplace Wellbeing. Really where that business started is sort of 15 years ago, I started my career in HR. I very much saw what happened when wellbeing was supported in the workplace versus when it also wasn't supported as well. That really grew my interest, but also a lot of my drive was from my own personal experiences with challenges with my health and wellbeing. And it really opened my eyes from my own personal story, which I'm sure we'll get into too shortly as well. But how actually the workplace can be a great source of support for people, and it can really encourage them, get them back to work much earlier, or remain in the workplace as well when you do have that correct support in place. So workplace wellbeing very much is about, you know, supporting people's wellbeing within the workplace, not only when we talk from maybe a professional angle, you know, in terms of their professional health and wellbeing, but also the personal challenges that we have with our own health and wellbeing through the course of our working life. And it's coming from a place from myself and my associates as well, where, you know, we're not coming from a place of judgment. We all get, everyone's at a different starting point. We recognize this is a journey. It's not a destination for people. It's an ongoing process. And very much it's about us helping organizations, you know, achieve that, helping their well-being for their people and making it easier for them to do so as well.
Thank you. Brilliant intro. Let's just unpack this word of well-being, because it gets branded around a lot, but let's slow it down and go, what do we mean when you're talking about workplace well-being, and link that to some of the things that you might do training on?
Okay, so when we look at like the definition of well-being in itself, it's about a person saying that they're happy, they're healthy, and they're comfortable. So the first thing that we need to recognize when it comes to well-being is it's very individual. So we can't think everyone's got to fit in a box, because what I might define as I feel happy, healthy, and comfortable might be completely different to you, Rachel, and to you, John. You know, we will all have a different definition of what that looks like. When we're also talking about well-being, we also need to factor in that we've got pillars of well-being. So, you know, which is great at the minute. We hear a lot about mental health and well-being, which is perfect, but we've got our physical health and well-being, we've got our professional health and well-being, we've got financial health and well-being, and we've also got social health and well-being. So actually, there's lots of pillars. So when we're talking about some of the challenges that organizations or leaders may face, is that what we need to acknowledge is there are these different pillars, but what people will define as good, what looks happy, what looks comfortable in each of those will actually differ. So a big challenge that, you know, often companies will face is recognizing, firstly, you need to be curious. You need to understand what are the health and well-being challenges of your people, because not everyone will want support for the same thing. Some people may want support with their mental health and well-being. Others may find that actually it's the financial health and well-being that they need help with. But when we talk about overall wellness, what we need to recognize is that we have to focus on all pillars. If we just focus on one, that won't result in overall wellness for us all, because ultimately all the pillars support one another for that overall sense of well-being. So some as well, what we need to recognize is not all pillars work in isolation. So do menopause training, for example. So that's going to tick off your mental, your physical pillar, most definitely, because we're going to learn about that. What we also know is there's a close link between the effects of menopause and impacts on mental health. So again, that's going to start looking at that pillar. In addition to that as well, that may also work on our social pillar, because actually if you start to build menopause workshops, communities within your organisation, you're already going to feel socially connected to other people who are going through similar circumstances as well. So you don't have to see them all in isolation, but you have to recognise though that all the pillars are there as well. And when we look at menopause as well in the professional sense, we only need to look at recent statistics of how many women are leaving their jobs because of the impacts of menopause and the lack of awareness and support in the organisation around that as well. So you can see how there can be a crossover around the pillars.
Claire, you cover that really, really succinctly. The one thing that really jumped out on me is the word curious. Leaders need to be curious about the individual and what may be actually happening with them.
Yeah.
How easy do you find it to be able to sell this work that you do, and you do speak really eloquently about it, into the workplace, when often leaders, I'm not saying everybody, but can have their own idea that, well, look, I'm okay, so if I'm all right, everybody else should be okay.
What I always talk about there is curiosity absolutely is important, but also so is the ability to offer someone your empathy and empathize with a situation that, you know, a big teaching that we have, particularly around the mental health first aid, is that you don't have to have gone through something yourself for it to be real. So you have to realize that, like when we talk about depression, you know, we can have people who, you know, which, you know, when we think about very stigmatized views of depression and mental illness, oh, I don't believe in all of that. You know, I just think it's this, I think it's that. When we talk about is, remember, the feelings don't have to be real for you for them to be real for someone else. So actually, if you don't adopt that principle, then all you're saying is that, you know, basically everyone has to follow me. Everyone, you know, well-being has to be the same as mine. You know, I've never had that, so I don't understand why other people don't. So a big part of that, you know, as well as the curiosity, is to have the empathy and to also have the ability to validate. So it's to say to someone, I've not been through that personally, but what I can see is that you're going through something that's very challenging on your health and well-being. And, you know, and I'm sorry that that's the situation that you're in. But as a leader, what I'm going to say to you is, I'm going to validate the situation is what it is. I'm not going to judge you up to this point or why you've got to this position or how that's happened for you. What my focus should be on is how can we move this forward positively for you? And that is where we talk about the curiosity, the empathy, and the validation as well.
Yeah, it's that full emotional intelligence suite, isn't it? But ultimately, I guess it just really depends on whether people in a leadership position or any position where they're dealing with other people care.
Yeah, definitely. And I've had, you know, I've had some challenging delegates on my courses throughout the years who really have had quite a negative view coming into training, you know, very much see this as, oh, it's a tick box exercise, yeah. You know, it becomes this, but sometimes as well, when you go into a group setting, often leaders are working with people who they don't realize are probably going through some things themselves, you know. So actually, and it's not until you get that group together and one's brave enough to say, actually, I've been there, I've done that. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh my goodness, someone, you know, who's working at the same level of us has suddenly raised their hand and said that that's been a struggle for them. And I think that's sometimes the beauty of getting, you know, those individuals together to train, to actually normalize it and say, you know, it doesn't mean you're weak because you felt that or that's happened to you. It's actually, you know, when we talk about it, it's, you know, it takes a lot of courage for people to say they're not happy, they're not healthy, they're not comfortable. And it takes a lot of courage to then say that, but then what a lot of bravery to then act on that and to want to improve that situation as well. So many times we can mask things, we can want to, you know, pull back and sort of be, you know, pretend everything's okay. But all we know is that that's a slippery slope and you're only heading in one direction when you're masking. So,
yeah, it's a good good lesson around leaders go first, yeah, isn't it? Where, you know, if a leader's brave enough and, like you say, has the courage to do that, then that gives people in the room that permission to share their story then, and all of a sudden everybody starts meeting people at different levels and different levels of appreciation as to what's actually going on with them.
So let's make this super easy for somebody that's thinking about this and thinking about the pillars of well-being in a different way, perhaps for the first time. So I think a lot of organizations today will have some form of mental health training in the workplace, but they might not have gone past mental health first aid. So talk us through good mental health in the workplace and what a lot of people will come across.
So when we're talking about good mental health in the workplace, we're talking about, you know, employees that are engaged, they're motivated, they're productive, they're happy at work. They, you know, they feel connected, they feel valued. These are the types of things that we can see when, you know, when that culture is right and, you know, mental health is managed well within the workplace. We also see when it looks good in the workplace, what we also see is the availability of toolkits, because like stress, for example, is something, you know, that we could talk a lot when we talk a lot about the workplace as well. So it's about realizing that you can go to your manager safely and say, I feel really stressed today, I need to do something about it, rather than being met with a response of, well, aren't we all, what do you want me to do about it? You know, it's more those conversations, and that's where you actually, yeah, again, it's that validation point, isn't it, that, you know, I recognize that we're at a different place at the moment. So that really is what good looks like, when the culture's there and it's supporting it, the messaging's there. But from the individual itself, it's the productivity, it's the engagement, it's the right motivation, morale, you know, you can start to see, and just a happier employee as well, you know, someone who wants to be there rather than someone who just feels it's, you know, negatively impacting their mental health.
That's interesting, because normally when we think about mental health first aid, you've picked up on stress, which I don't think I've ever met anybody in what we do, John, of you, that's not stressed at work at times. Yeah. When I've been on mental health first aid or training before, you immediately go to depression and like suicide awareness and stuff. And obviously that's a part of it, isn't it? Like being able to spot those signs, because that has a detrimental impact on productivity in the workplace. But you're really saying that the mental health awareness is a spectrum from being stressed through depression.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's where, and a lot of the time as well, stress is positioned so negatively as well. So I think as well, we need to, you know, acknowledge as well that not all stress is bad for us. You know, we can cope with certain amounts in healthy ways. But what we do need to validate is that we've all got a different level of vulnerability to it. You know, we've got our work pot, say that's our work pot, but we've also got our outside pots as well. So you might have an employee who's come in to work, they've got a stress container and it's 95% full before they've even stepped through the door, because there's something going on outside of work that has actually already got them to a certain level. You might give them what you deem to be quite a reasonable task in the workplace, and all of a sudden you see this explosive reaction and you think, wow, you know, why have you reacted so big, or, you know, badly to that request for that task? And that's where we also need to realize that stress does play a big part. Stress, as I say, is something that we can receive in all different forms. We're all individuals. What we classify as stress is different between us all. But what we also need to see in the workplace is that if we are putting undue stress consistently on our employees, then actually we are increasing the risk of them developing poor mental health, because we're not assessing that risk. We're not saying, actually, you know, is that reasonable? Is that too much? How can we change that? If you look at the Thriving at Work document report, I think it was written about 2017, 2018, it talked about the different elements of where, you know, workplaces should be reviewing stress within the workplace as well. So again, it's really, really important that we acknowledge, you know, that stress needs to be validated, that when people put their hand up and say, I feel too stressed, that we do something about it. We don't brush it away as, oh, you can't cope with your job, or, you know, maybe you're not the right person for this, or, you know, you know, when we start judging the person, because often a lot of times is with stresses, it can be managed with the right techniques. We can look at what's been labeled as stress and what's coming in stressful. If it's work related, leaders have got a lot of power over that to change that and influence that as well. But also as well, we need to help people adopt, you know, techniques. What happens a lot with stress conversations in the workplace is it becomes a competition. You know, I'm more stressed than you because I've got this and you've got that. It also we become very judgmental. You know, people, like we know from the statistics, are frightened to ring in sick from stress to work because actually of the fear of the judgment of saying that. But again, what we need to focus on is validate the feelings. If someone says that that's how they feel, validate it. And what the teachings of the course does is teaches you then how do we move it forward positively. So rather than staying in the judgment stage, let's validate and quickly get it into the positive and the frame of moving forward as well.
Is that the actual training that you give people then, Claire, so that when those situations present themselves, that they have all the tools in the box to be able to deal with them? Or do you often get cases where people may just actually contact you because they have a certain scenario that they need specialist advice on?
Yeah, it's a mixture of both, really. So when we do the training, we go through a model called the stress container, and that talks all about vulnerability and what goes in people's pots and how we manage it. So we give the basics around that. Because I've got the background in HR as well, I always like to add some further, you know, context to those materials and encourage people to challenge me with scenarios, you know, and say, you know, give me a scenario that's maybe going off in your team. But also as well, then we can work with people one-on-one. We've also got a stress course as well that, you know, that we can, you know, run through some materials as well with people where if they're wanting to learn more about that individually as well. So It really, you know, there is a mixture of both, but all of the courses do talk about stress, but we have got the provision to go into much further detail should people want to as well, if they've got, you know, particularly difficult scenarios. And I find that often comes about when usually what happens is we've already got a reactive situation going on. So we've already not done the groundwork. So usually people will come to me in those situations because it's already snowballed and we're already way into a situation that's played out. So actually a big part of our training is about being proactive. You know, don't just react when the problem develops. How do we, you know, minimize the chances of people getting to this point is by actually doing the proactive work. So like you mentioned earlier, Rachel, I think a lot of people, when they think about mental health, they just think about the illness side. A big part of our courses as well is talking about mental wellness, which we all tend to neglect quite a bit, because when we talk about mental health, people immediately think of mental illness. What they don't realize is we've all got mental health. It's like our physical health. It can be in a good place, it can be in a neutral place, or it can be in a poor place. So it's, you know, it's very much about, you know, we also teach the what does wellness look like? How do we keep ourselves in wellness? What are the toolkits we should have ready? So then if we do find ourselves becoming unwell, we've easily got them to hand. We're not firefighting those situations.
Yeah, I think what you talked about then with stress and what you mentioned before about the pillars, you can already see how stress overlaps all the pillars. So I don't know many people at the moment that aren't stressed financially. There's then stress about your health and what you might have going on at home. There's then stress about the workplace and the economy.
Yeah.
you could be stressed if you were in the menopause, for example. So it does all massively overlap. What I'm interested in is these scenarios that you talked about, Claire, because I think this kind of thought process gets people thinking differently. And yeah, it does often present when it's got to crisis situation. Could you perhaps walk us through a couple of scenarios in quite different, maybe two quite different organisations, of how stress might first present itself and then how that might impact people in an organisation?
Yeah. So I think one organisation I worked for was in the oil industry, predominantly male in terms of an environment, working very unsociable hours, very long hours, very difficult, I think, you know, in terms of your sleep pattern, you know, so it would be like 2 days, two nights and very long, very sort of minimal break in between, and then you'd be back into it again. When I delivered training for that organization, I could feel the stress in the room. Like, I could feel very angry people, almost angry that the organization was investing in this training, because it was like, well, this seems like a bit of a back reaction to all the, you know, the difficulties we've been facing, you know, and it just feels like it's a tick box now. And that was the attitude that I was met with, you know, so it was almost, I had to unpick that, go back, get them to a neutral stage, and then move it forward positively. So a big part of that process was listening to the concerns. So I said, look, before we even get into this training, I can feel, you know, I can feel sort of like, you know, the tension in the room towards the company about your mental health and, you know, and sort of your physical health as well. So I said, let's start this session by actually understanding your concerns. What is it particularly that is, you know, upsetting you about, you know, maybe the current environment that you work in? So that was one of the scenarios where we took that feedback first. Then we use that feedback and weave that then throughout the training as well. So a big part of that was, you know, stress around the impact on your physical health with sleep patterns as well. You know, there was lack of sort of support and care. So then that then led for a recommendation for me to say that you've got these individuals that are on these shifts. What support do you offer to help them with their sleep patterns? You know, do you give the education around, you know, if you're coming back from a night shift at 7 a.m., you know, telling me that you need to drink two bottles of beer to go to sleep is not a healthy approach. What are you doing to help those individuals to actually, you know, get the right sleep hygiene patterns? You know, have you educated them around what that looks like? So that was, you know, a really good scenario of actually listening to, you know, the sort of the upset really from a lot of them. And you could see they were really angry with the organization as well, because unfortunately, they felt the training at first was just a tick box, you know, to say, oh, we've done it. But actually, by listening to their views, you know, taking the teachings that I was going to give them anyway, and then talking to them, a big part about them was the stress container and saying, you know, sleep's going to be a big thing that's landing in your containers. What we need to do is adopt and think, you know, how can we feed that back to the organization where we can look at how that's impacting you? But also, you know, what can we help to do, you know, to help you with that? Because a lot of the time people will just say, oh, I'm unhappy, the organization's no good. But actually we need to push back and say, but what would be helpful then? What do you need, you know, help with in terms of managing your stress levels maybe around those different times as well?
I just want to mention, actually, fair play to that organization in this, because that's quite a leap when you've got people that are that angry and you can feel emotion. But for that organisation to step into that space of even bringing you in, it's got to start somewhere, hasn't it? And I think these are difficult conversations, but it's about not bringing on somebody that's just going to be a tick boxing exercise, and about actually bringing on board a consultant or a company that can hold a space to go, let's get curious about what's going on here and try and work through it together on how we can solve this.
I think very perceptive on you as well, Claire. You know, being able to use that feedback, because I think that is definitely taking it away from being a tick box exercise for the people that are in that room, because they absolutely understand that you care. Very perceptive.
Yeah, and I think because And I think a lot of the time as well, and I've, you know, not seen it necessarily in that organisation, but other ones as well, is that too many times I hear, oh, well, they're paid well. Well, that's irrelevant. Do you know what I mean? Because that doesn't mitigate the impacts that they're feeling, you know, and I think, again, that's not validating, is it? It's not validating and saying, do you know what? You know, here's, you know, really well done. We know that the night shifts are hard, you know, and it's almost that, you know, saying that, you know, it is something hard to go through. We recognise the impacts, but when you just met with responses, oh, well, you paid well for it. It's, again, that validation doesn't come in, does it? That actually there are challenges. And like you were saying there as well, Rachel, you know, that you do react differently when you're tired. We've all been there, haven't we? I think when we've had bad night's sleeps, haven't we? And you're not as, you know, tolerant to things, and, you know, you can snap at people, can't you? And it's, you know, that's the reality of, you know, sort of your impacted sleep patterns, isn't it? So,
yeah. And you can get really sophisticated with this stuff, because I imagine when you're working in the oil industry, you operate in really expensive machinery. People's lives are at stake. Being tired can absolutely have detrimental impacts. So it's about understanding that correlation between this isn't a nice to have. This is about a more productive workforce, which means greater profits for the organization, which because you have less sickness, because you have better team camaraderie, because you have feelings where everybody's got each other's backs.
Yeah.
It's, do you see these patterns, and how do you help organizations kind of quantify the value of this? Because the thing we come up against so much is, this all sounds great, but I don't have time.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is, again, saying that whilst short term it feels like a lot of effort, you've got to think of the long term gains as well. You know, even if you just look at, you know, statistics. So I think Deloitte had done a recent study, and they said, I think it was in, they looked at 2020 to 2021. I think 30.8 million working days were lost due to ill health. So you're already looking at that. That's an average of, what, 18-ish days per person, you know. So, again, you look at the impacts of that. We also know from statistics, look at presenteeism. So when you've got people in that organisation that should not be there because they are not well enough to be there as well, we know that that accounts for twice as many losses in not only, like, accidents, levels of customer service. So again, you're losing customers because people aren't, you know, in the right frame of mind or place to be there as well. We also know, you know, particularly when we're looking at mental health as well, is that 28% of people saying they're leaving their jobs because of the impact it's having on their mental health. So it's all about, like, that loss of talent, isn't it? The productivity as well. And I think it's almost seen, you know, if you look at this as a short-term strategy, yes, it's not going to look like it's worth its money, because you're actually, the mindset's wrong. Like we know with well-being, it is a journey. It's not just a destination. You've not got to just do mental health training once and think, right, that's the organisation covered, we don't need to talk to them again or reinvest. It has to be a consistent, ongoing process, because it's like all of our health. I started work at, you know, God, what was it, 21, no health issues, get to 20, God, if I think about my memory now, get to 26, had an ectopic pregnancy, took me out of work for 6 weeks. And when I came back, it was very much like, oh, no one ask her about it, we'll just assume she's okay. That had long-term impacts on my mental health. Fast forward four years later, went into the early menopause, which wouldn't have been expected of me of my age, but I had surgery and went into early menopause. That had a whole host of other detrimental impacts to me and my mental health as well. You know, and we can't foresee what's going to happen in the future. I hope that that's it for me in terms of the health and well-being challenges moving forward. But you don't know. And that's, you know, we've got an aging workforce. We've all got different demographics, you know, in terms of our, you know, in terms of male versus females as well. You know, in terms of, you know, other genders as well, you know, there's lots of different things that are going on where there are health challenges. Even as well, if you look, you know, in terms of people's mental health, we know that one in six people of the working age population will experience some difficulty with their mental health during their working life. So again, it starts to pick up, doesn't it, the different numbers.
Yeah, definitely. On that, and thank you for sharing your personal journey. We might dig into a little bit of that as the conversation progresses. But I think what would be really useful is let's break down three scenarios that may be topical in a workplace at certain points. And so the scenarios that we could perhaps cover are when there's a death in the workplace. Let's talk about, after that, if we could do some scenarios around menopause, because it's so topical at the moment. And like you said, an aging workforce and needing a more equal workforce. We're going to come up against that a lot. And then smartphone addiction, I think, with like Gen Z in the workplace. And so three topics. Talk us through what you might do and what might be going on for a way that might educate leaders in any of those scenarios with things that they might not have thought about before.
Yeah. Okay. So if we were talking, for example, in the workplace, there may have been, a death, whether that's through a fatality or a suicide. One of the things that we would look at that as well is that we have to be aware that that can be a traumatic experience for people. So you don't have to. So when we talk about vicarious trauma, what we can talk about is there is that you don't have to have gone through something personally for it to impact you. Okay. So again, this may say if there was a fatality on a site, it may have been at another site, but you work for that organization, you operate the same sort of machinery where that accident may have happened, you know, in the way in which that accident has happened. So what organizations need to be aware of is ripple effects. You know, so yes, we can have the immediate people who may need support, but we also need to manage the rippling out of those effects as well. And often with trauma, what we see is people, we can see things called like ASD, which is acute stress disorder, where this is where people usually have a heightened reaction in the sort of like the 2 weeks after an event. So you can see that you will see a very strong heightened reaction there. Some people then can go on to develop something called PTSD. So this is longer lasting, where it is having those real detrimental impacts. So if I had an example in an organization where there was a fatality, I would be thinking as a leader, me having one conversation with someone to say, are you okay, is not enough. You know, what we need to be saying is we need to be having consistent conversations with these individuals, because what we often see with trauma is people particularly focus almost on the physical recovery of it, particularly if they've been involved in it. And it's usually the impacts mentally we start to see developing later as well. So it's actually having that recognition that really for that first year post that accident, that fatality, whatever's happened, there needs to be those regular check-in points, because there will be some people who immediately cry. Their response will come out immediately from them. Others, they will bottle, and you might see it in 6 months' time instead. You might see it in a year's time. But what you might see is not in the normal way you would expect it. If someone's sitting down and having a good cry about it, you might then see that employee that's turning up and starting to misuse alcohol, and you're smelling that alcohol on them, because that's now become a coping mechanism for the distressing feelings as a result of that scenario that's played out as well. So any leader really in those sort of circumstances needs to be having that regular check-in. Likewise, if you've got an employee who's lost, sort of like a loved one or someone like that, it's having those regular check-ins, you know, 6 months down, you know, are you aware of any birthdays or poignant anniversaries that are associated with that person? Also the year anniversary of that person's passing as well. These are all dates that we should be bearing in mind and actually saying, you know, reaching out to that person saying, you know, really appreciate today might be a really hard day for you, and giving that allowance to that person on that day to maybe have a quiet day, a day off, or whatever they need just to be able to deal with maybe the resurfacing of emotions that might come forward for them as well. But one thing we also need to recognize when there's sort of like a death or a fatality is there's no rule book on how you should react. I think that's often the misconception is, oh, well, you know, Bill's coping with it okay, so why isn't Sue now? You know, it's not a competition, because we're all individuals. How we process it, how we deal with it, and how long it takes for us to overcome or manage those feelings are going to be different for everyone. So it's recognizing that need to stay, monitor the individual as well.
Yeah, that's really useful, that, Claire. I think there's a couple of other things I'd just point out. That we've seen, and we obviously come across it from the L&D point of view, but I'd like your view on it. You mentioned alcohol as a coping mechanism, but we've also seen behaviours that can look more like they're organisational appropriate, but they can still be quite negative if overused. So like an over-reliance on rules and procedure to not put yourself in any physical risk, which then has a detrimental impact on team building.
Yeah.
We can then have the like hiding behind, if I don't know it's going on, then I'm not to blame. And the other things as well, I think, is never assuming that you know what's happened with other people in their past, because suicide isn't something that, you know, you might only know about it if it happens at somebody's lifetime in work, but you might not know what's happened to people when they were younger. You might have this all hands meeting to talk about something and not understand that that's massively triggering for a couple of individuals.
Yes.
That are there. In those cases, what advice would you offer about how people can perhaps be a little bit more aware, a little bit more considerate to these varying ripple effects that things like trauma and fatalities might have?
So I think a big part of that, I think it is the empathy again, is recognizing that, you know, sometimes the way you react, it doesn't mean that everyone has to react the same way or deal with things the same way as well. I think you're very right as well. I think you've got to be observant, you know, what is the change in that person? Well, hang on a minute, before the accident or the suicide, for example, that wasn't sort of what I would classify as their normal. So actually there's been a change. And I think it's approaching that change from a position of care rather than criticism. So, you know, I am concerned because I've seen X, Y, and Z changes in you, and I'd really like to explore why they are. We had a lot of these conversations around people returning after COVID as well, you know. So I know we're slightly going off topic, but, you know, well, why can they come back really quickly and you're sort of like digging your heels in and you're not coming back? And it's actually because when we try and group everyone the same way and just push you all into one sort of box and assume that everyone will take the news the same way, everyone react the same way, this is where we fall short in terms of our true ability to care for people. Because while we may have the majority go in a certain way, we have to still validate that there will be others that will do it in different ways. So like you're saying there, Rachel, you know, someone who may become overly reliant on those health and safety procedures. And what we might need to explore behind that is that accident or fatality or suicide, whatever it is, may have then triggered an anxiety response in them, which actually then is, you know, they are now struggling to manage themselves because they are that anxious that that's going to be the same outcome for them. So rather than criticizing that person for those behaviors, those thoughts, those feelings, it's about taking the time to sit down and understand them and to actually say to that person, what steps can we take to reassure you that you are safe? You know, and even if that means we step you through the process, you know, in really small steps, but with the same aim of getting to that end goal as well. I think too often businesses feel that they don't have time, so we just try and push you to the end goal immediately. And then we get frustrated when you're not getting there as quickly as we would like you to be there. And then that becomes then a whole other host of conversations around ability to do your job. And actually, if you look at that person before that took place, you knew that person could do that job. But what we need to recognize is there's something from their environment which has changed their thoughts, their feelings and behaviors. And we need to help them manage that and move that forward positively as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, often if it is a fatality at work, there's often a legal investigation as well. Yeah. But I think what I think is interesting about this is how that all of that can add to the stress container, the like lessons learned, the revisiting procedures, but that adds to the stress container, which makes people less able to manage their anxiety, or their anxiety might manifest in different ways that might also be detrimental. And I think I like that about stepping through it really slowly and perhaps at different times, because you can't just do it once, but not everybody's in the same place at the same time. You might have to do that on the 2-year anniversary, on the 3-year anniversary. You might have to do it on the 5-year anniversary, and how you collectively heal through a traumatic experience because everybody heals at different rates and moves forward at a different pace.
Yeah.
So that's super useful. Let's move on to menopause, if that's okay. Yeah. Well, how might issues around wellness in the workplace and menopause present, and what approach might you take to people going through the menopause? You shared your experience. You went through the menopause really early in your 30s, yeah. Enforced menopause. But when we think about that could happen, but it's obviously rare. But for most women, you know, between the ages of 40 to 55, perimenopause, menopausal mm-hmm. symptoms, how can leaders be more aware of it? How can they be more supportive? And what do we need to consider when thinking about, you know, women going through the menopause in the workplace?
Yeah, I think, you know, firstly, we just need to validate it's something that's going to happen. You know, I think that's a big
population.
Part of it. Yeah, yeah, when we think about that. So I think it's understanding your demographics as well, you know, and realising that, you know, if you've got that workforce, that they will be getting to a point where, you know, at some point women will be going through the menopause. I think for leaders, what we need to see it as is it's not just an issue for those that are going through it. And I think that's a big part of this process as well, is because what if you're a male line manager and you've got an employee who's going through the menopause? Is it because you're a man that you suddenly then aren't able to talk about that? So when I think about awareness for menopause, I think it's great for an organization to give everyone awareness training in it, because it's just that understanding. Because whether you might not be going through it yourself, you may have a wife who is, girlfriend, mother, sister, whoever. So at some point you will come into contact with someone who will be going through that. I also think as well then that you need to push back to the organization and the employees and say, what would you find helpful? Because for some, they are happy with the awareness training. For others, you know, they want to see, you know, and best practice would be to having that menopause policy there, you know, so they can understand, you know, as well, the support that they can get. Other organisations like to adopt a programme of menopause champions. So people with common interest who are really there to support that message and really to be the eyes and ears in the organisation to say, actually, you know, when we're talking about from our group of champions, you know, we'd like the organisation to consider this or to offer this, so they can be providing recommendations as well. Because champions are a really good way as well, because if we place all the emphasis on the leadership team to identify everything, things will get missed, okay? Because, you know, unfortunately, that is what can happen. So actually, when we talk about, you know, menopause champions, having them throughout the organisation means that people can be observing, you know. So if I'm in this role and I'm customer facing, I'm having a hot floor, it should be really helpful if I did have that fan or I had that ability to just say, can I have 5 minutes, etc. So it's really good to have a reflective group of your workforce and the roles that they perform as well, because then you can really understand actually as well the different, you know, sort of offerings that you can take. But as a bare minimum as well for an organisation, I would say is to upskill your line managers in menopause awareness as well, is so that they understand that actually if someone comes with you with a concern about either their perimenopause or their menopause, that you don't suddenly shudder and think, oh, goodness, I can't have this conversation, but that you're confident, you've got the skills to have it. And what we always teach on our courses is, I'm not asking you to be their GP or their counsellor or their menopause specialist, but what I'm asking you to do is have a productive conversation with that individual, validate the symptoms that they're going through, and then take action to take those symptoms to someone as well who can help you in terms of moving that forward positively. I think a lot of line managers get scared with like mental health training, all these different trainings that I'm suddenly going to be someone's GP. I need to diagnose them. I need to be their counsellor. And that's not the case. We're not asking anyone to replace any medical professionals, but you are a key part in taking that person who may be in distress, validating that distress, and then helping them move it forward positively by getting them to the recognised signposting supports that might be available as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Nat, because it can be quite frightening to have that level of responsibility on you, might it? And we certainly know from menopause, it lasts a long time.
Yeah.
But just listening and validating somebody's feelings can totally change somebody's mindset.
Yeah, Definitely, definitely. I think someone just saying, I can see you going through a difficult time, can do the world of good, and actually being heard, you know, being believed in and being listened to is so powerful. You know, people say, well, I've only listened, but you won't realise how powerful that ability to really listen to someone is. And I think it can have such a positive impact on the next steps for that person as well.
Yeah, definitely. And then moving on to smartphone addiction. So you do training on this. But yeah, talk us through what you're looking at when you're looking at smartphone addiction and anything in particular that impacts people that are line managing younger people.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we're probably all guilty of looking at our screen time from time to time and thinking, my goodness grief, have I been on my phone that long? And I think, yeah, really the idea and principles around this is that, you know, a lot of the research does show that the negative impacts of, you know, being on the phone does have for younger people. But we're also talking as well about, you know, now, you know, many people are in organisations, you're immediately handed an iPhone where your work emails are on that as well. So actually, it's not allowing you really to switch off, is it? So even at home, you've got emails that are pinging through at all times. So really, this course teaches us, you know, about, you know, the boundaries of what's healthy, you know, so we can't, you know, sit here and say, well, just get rid of your phone, we just all won't have phones anymore. You know, the way the world is going, we are technology driven. It's all about social, you know, outlets as well. But really, this course is very much more around, you know, what's a healthy boundary? What does it look like when it starts to be impacting on our mental and physical health as well? And how do we mitigate that? And it's really about those good hygiene, you know, rules. And, you know, how do we keep that to a healthy boundary where it's not, as I say, negatively impacting that person as well? And I think, yes, if you look at maybe the apps that people use, they can maybe be more assigned depending on your age group as well. So particularly, as you say, you know, like with younger individuals, we do see a lot of that emphasis on social media. We do also work with organisations because a lot of education has to come around with what's appropriate to post and not to post. You know, it's that education piece as well. But what we also need to, you know, what we teach as well is the importance of recognizing that little device, which some people don't value as much as others, for those that value it a lot, it can be a massive source of validation. So if you're not getting those likes on those posts and all that interaction that you are hoping for, then that can really start to negatively impact your mental health as well. So it is giving that real picture about, you know, what's healthy screen time? How do we set the boundaries? You know, how do you spot the signs and symptoms of when it's becoming unhealthy and it's not productive and, you know, and positive on your sense of health and well-being as well? And I think it's a real eye-opener for a lot of people, you know, in terms of, because, you know, the amount of times I think we put our hands up and you'll say, God, I've been scrolling on Instagram for an hour and I don't even know what I've been looking at. And a lot of it is we are very passively looking, you know, so it's, you know, when we talk about mindfulness, our devices often take our ability away from being able to be present in the moment. So we go on autopilot. So we start living our life through what's on our phones rather than putting it to one side, enjoying the moment that we're in, you know, and managing it. And it's about us controlling our use rather than the use controlling us. And I think it's about, you know, creating that right sort of balance between the use as well.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting because we're given these things without any education or awareness of what they can do. John and I were running a workshop a couple of weeks ago actually, and I'll pose this question because this comment came up and it would be useful to get a professional like yourself's view on it. Obviously the boundary between work and home is blurred, and we work with a lot of senior leaders that have a lot of pressure on themselves and might work on social hours, and we hear this a lot. You know, I choose to work out of hours and I'll email on a weekend and I'll work late, but my team know that I don't expect them to reply.
Yeah.
So we talk a lot in that instance about role modelling because people will say, you know, I work late, but I don't expect my team to. And obviously that's only expedited by the device.
Yes.
What's your view on that kind of behaviour and language?
I think it's a hard one because it is down to, it is personal preference, isn't it? I mean, I'm a big advocate, obviously being with health and wellbeing, that we need adequate downtime and, you know, and that we're managing those boundaries, you know, in terms of those hours. But what I would also say is that, you know, it's, you have to be very clear that if you do choose to work those hours, that those around you don't feel the pressure to respond, you know, and I think that's a big part of that. So some of the trends we're even seeing in workplaces now is, say, if, you know, your individual circumstances might be that you do have to have 3 hours or 2 hours out your day and you do have to make that time up later. So that might be because of your individual circumstances. So one of the things that, you know, that we do see in trends in organisations as well is even writing in email headers as well, you know, in terms of please don't reply until you're working hours. So again, that sort of sets that expectation. We also, as well, what we do is that we encourage people to put their office hours on the bottom of email, you know, sort of the footers as well, your out of office responses as well. So again, it takes that panic away that if someone does send you an email that you suddenly need to be responding or replying at those different times as well. All I say is that we are working a more flexible work, you know, a place of work where we are now, more flexible sort of approach. The big thing for me, though, as a health and wellbeing consultant is, you know, it's up to you when you choose to work those hours. But what we should be regularly monitoring is that we're not regularly exceeding them, because that is where it isn't becoming as healthy for people. So when you choose to work them, that might be down to your individual preference. But what we have to do is make sure that we don't criticize others that don't regularly exceed them, because ultimately that's what they're paid for, to do those hours. And if we've, you know, we've done the job description well and we are paying accordingly, people should be able to get that work done in that time as well. I know that there'll always be times where you may slightly go over at certain points, but it shouldn't be the norm, and it shouldn't be expected of people that to be on call 24/7, to be answering 24/7, because ultimately all that'll happen is people will start to burn out. So then they will need to take some time away from the business, because it's going to start snowballing for them as well.
Yeah, that's really useful. And I think we definitely talk about that, wouldn't we, John, when we're talking about stress and end of projects, you would expect to see people going over, but you need adequate downtime thereafter. Yeah. And you need to be managing those energy flows to keep a high performance. A high performance organization requires downtime as well. Yes. As periods of peak performance. So it's just balancing that. That's super useful. Is there anything else that you think would be really useful to touch on before we wrap up?
I think one of the things that I would certainly recommend, because I know a lot of organisations at first do say to me, oh, you know, where do we start? You know, how do we get going on this? So what I always say is that, you know, you've got to aim for progress, not perfection. Too many times I see organisations trying to plan these massive activities and it just becomes a one-off out of a year. It's much more effective as an organization if you do, for say, 6 mini things over the course of the year, because you're creating that consistency. Also, as well, when we think about that, is have a calendar of events that you're going to start committing to. You know, so if you can put that sort of, if you can do 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. And even if you start by saying, do you know what we're going to do is we're to start this process, we're going to get behind national campaigns. And that's going to be our starting point, because we're going to sort of float it a bit out there. There's lots of great national campaigns around health and well-being. You know, you've got Mental Health Awareness Week, you've got Heart Health, you've got Hydration Week, you've got Loneliness Week. So you can get behind a lot of the campaigns that will hit all of these pillars. This allows you to start the momentum going as well. But also as well is start to take the time to invest and be curious with your people. You could, and I kid you not, if you looked at some of the awareness calendars, you could do something every day. Okay, there is that many things that are going on. You could do something every day. But what you need to do is start selecting things that are going to have a direct impact on the people that are working for you. So it's not about plucking things out of the air, but it is, you know, national campaigns are a great way to get the message going. But then you need to start tailoring it down, you know, actually, what are the specific challenges? What are the specific needs of individuals? And let's really target and tailor to those, because that's where we're going to see the maximum output from as well.
Claire, thank you so much for putting all of that into context. I've been trying to sort of think up a summary really for a leader in terms of why they should be doing this and how they would go about it. And I think it's really interesting that you use these, what's the definition of well-being? So we talked about happiness, healthiness, and being comfortable. And that this crosses these four pillars of well-being, which if I'm right, were social, financial, health, and mental.
Yeah, so we've got mental, physical, financial, social. Yeah.
Thanks for pointing me right on the physical.
Yeah.
What I've picked up is that you have put an awful lot of meat on the bones here. And I think it's really useful for organizations to be able to see that. But most of people's thinking is hidden. Yeah. And the behaviors that we see are not necessarily aligned with their thinking because we don't know what that it actually is. Yeah. And so I've sort of thought it's your role to get that out in the open in a safe way for people within an organization. And that in turn widens people's perspective because they've now been able to share their own thoughts and feelings about how they approach their own well-being. So I think it's such a useful thing. I think people need to get on board and get some activities in the diary. And so I guess I'm leading up to really, what are your three leadership essentials that are in the context of well-being?
Yeah, so I think certainly number one is about the curiosity. I think it's about seeking to understand, you know, the challenges that come alongside health and well-being, but looking across all of the pillars to do that, you know, so really exploring. So not giving weight into one more than another, giving equal weight into them all and really seeing how we can support all of those different areas. I think a second one would definitely be the ability to demonstrate the empathy to people. I think, you know, we have to realize that we're all individuals. We've all got different life experiences. We've all got, you know, different ways we view things, different way we deal with things, different way we approach things. So we have to remember that the feelings, you know, whichever way, whichever pillar that they're coming under, just because they're not real for you, it doesn't mean that they're not real for someone else. So I think that's a big part of that. So it's about validating those feelings, but also demonstrating that empathy to those feelings and understanding and committing to say, we are where we are then. How do we think we can move that forward positively for you? And then finally, as well, I would say is around role modeling the behaviors, you know, so it's very good for us to say, oh, we've got to look after our health and well-being, but you're the one that's always seen to be first in, last out, really stressed, not looking after yourself, not eating well, sleeping well, you know, not appearing to be happy and engaged with the workplace. So it very much is about role modeling the behavior. And it's also about normalizing those well-being conversations. So don't wait until a problem develops. How do we take it more proactively? So I'm going to reach out to people regularly, ask how they are, find out more about them and normalize those conversations. So then if someone does get to a point where they're maybe not feeling very well in any of those pillars, they have the confidence to open up to me as well.
Yeah, that's great. Really great. I think just to wrap up on that, I really like what John started and then you touched on was, and I don't think we've really dug into this, but if you listen, and this is what we find in coaching, if you listen to people, provide them with a sounding board that they are way more likely to solve their own problem rather than you try and solve it for them. And I think if we can just connect that with what you said around, if you open yourself up to this stuff, you are not expected to be a GP or a menopause specialist or a suicide prevention specialist. And please do not feel as a leader that you're there to give advice. Like that's not the role of this.
Yeah.
Really, and we talk about this all the time in our coaching approaches, do not jump into solving somebody else's problem. Yeah. But if you provide a space where people can feel heard, feel that they've been validated, to use a word you've used a lot today, they are way more likely to solve their own problem and to seek the help that they need, which will in turn mean that they're taking less sickness days, that they're feeling more empowered at work, that they're feeling more productive, and that they're able to return to normal ways of working far quicker than if you don't listen to it, you don't acknowledge it. And to bring it back to that oil example that you gave, where it gets pushed down and then people start to be resentful, they start to feel blame associated with the organization, and then they start to think, well, I'm just going to take that day sick because they don't care. And you start to have these feelings of blame and resentment as opposed to empowerment and positive action. And I think if we just connect those two together, I think what you do in the wellness space and the well-being space, and from what I'm hearing about the approach you take in your consultancy, it's really quite similar to what we'd advocate as a coach, that it's a space of listening, non-judgment, and really promoting that you are the one that makes the best decisions for you in your life, and you are responsible for taking and empowered to take positive action.
Definitely. I think you're completely right there, because I always say with it, for example, you're so right in what you're saying, because when we think about, for example, like with mental health, you know, you can't change someone's thought process. You can't change their feelings. So this is where we are big advocates, like you're saying, Rachel, you and John are doing in the coaching space as well, is that we're saying, you know, no one's expecting you to be a solution provider or a fixer. You know, you're not there to take it off someone and go, right, I'll fix it and then give it back to you. That's not what the process is about. And I think too often people think that's what it is, and that's why they shy away from it, because they think, well, I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know how to resolve that for someone. And I think that then creates the fear. So actually, it's easy for me to step away rather than step into it. And I think we just need to get more comfortable with having difficult conversations. But remember, whatever level of uncomfortableness you're feeling as part of that conversation, they're going to be feeling it 10 times worse, okay? So what we've got to do is create a situation where we are comfortable with those conversations, and the outcome is always positive. And it's like, I'm really pleased that you shared this with me. And what I want to now do is highlight to you so I can be a source of support, but I want to also share all the other sources of support that are available to you as well. And as you say, the moment someone feels heard and believed in, that's going to open the door to that next positive step. If they feel dismissed, judged, told to sort of all get on with it, you'll be okay, they're just taking steps back, aren't they? They're not going in the right direction. But you're right what you say. No one is expecting a senior leader or a manager to be, you know, the fixer. You're not there to fix it. You are absolutely there to empower people. And you do that through validating them and giving them empathy and really, you know, promoting those positive forward steps.
Yeah, fabulous. And what a wonderful note to end on. So if people have thought, oh, Claire sounds interesting and we need to do a little bit more about workplace wellbeing, where can they find out more information about you, your company, your consultancy?
Yeah, so we have got a website, so www.workplace-wellbeing.co.uk. We are also on LinkedIn as well, so I would advocate that anyone can reach us either of those ways, and we'd be more than happy to talk to any companies about wellbeing, because it is our passion area, so absolutely.
And I should also mention, Claire's a little bit of an influencer in this space. You've got like 12,000 followers on LinkedIn, so you can also find Claire Burns, really worth a follower. You're really worth a follow, Claire, on the advice and support that you share on your LinkedIn.
Thank you for that, Claire. Is it just workplace WURK?
It is, yes.
PLACE. The people can definitely find you.
Thank you for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you found today's leadership essentials and coaching discussion points useful. If you'd like to read more about the approach we take, check out our website at scaffoldcoaching.com.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Audioboom, Google Podcasts, or wherever you like to get your podcasts from, and give us a rating so other people can find this content. You can also find us on Twitter or Instagram at scaffoldcoach.